Tonight, on Life on Earth, we look at a creature whose survival in the modern world continues to baffle scientists and laymen alike.
He's best known as a broadcaster, one of that select band who can transmit their enthusiasm to a mass audience.
He's been looking after major BBC documentary series and other endangered species for what seems like forever, and yet he grows younger every year.
He is David Attenborough.
Sir David Attenborough.
David Attenborough.
A young David Attenborough being interviewed.
Well, I personally get huge pleasure from seeing, let us say, a lake covered with flamingos in the early dawn in Africa, which is a marvellous, thrilling, exciting sight. And if I can communicate that pleasure to others through various devices like television cameras or whatever else, that is an enormous reinforcement of the pleasure for me.
David climbing a rope ladder on a boat.
If you look back before David started his broadcasting career, who knew what a coral reef was? Who knew what a tropical rainforest was? He's seen more things in the world than any other living being.
In Australia, North America, in Europe, and here in Africa. Here in the tiny Comoro Islands. Here in the tropical rainforest of Sumatra.
6 feet beneath the surface of the Earth.
200 miles south of Java.
And here we are.
Perry Wogan doing an impression of him.
He's always been that person. His hair's all over the place, etc. If you took a picture of Dave, age 12, it would fit perfectly with what he is now.
OK, well, standing by.
Sound Trevi.
Do you want a rehearsal?
First level, please.
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
OK, going for a take.
Sound, speed.
Action.
BBC. Life on Air. David Attenborough's 50 years in television. Presented by Michael Palin.
If David Attenborough has seen more things in the world than anyone else, he's also brought most of them back with him.
Shifts and expedience of camp life, travel and exploration. This is really what I need.
I've known David since Monty Python days, when he was one of the bosses of BBC Television.
Now then.
He likes to play a sort of quiz game on unsuspecting visitors.
Yes, well.
Object number three is?
Wow. Well, it's extremely heavy. I would have thought it was an egg of some kind, but I can't imagine any animal.
Yes, yes.
It is an egg. This has come from inside some creature.
It's an egg.
Dinosaur egg.
Full mark.
Really?
10 out of 10.
But I can't help feeling it's all just a playful way of hiding a very serious obsession.
Do you get books of every...
Yes.
Place you go
every.
To. I mean, your shelves are stocked. You see there almost every book on papier ever written in English. Is that...
Yeah.
That's important to you.
Don't ask me if I've read them all, though.
No. But if you hear that there's one you haven't got, you make sure you get it.
Yes. Do you?
No.
A man possessed by his enthusiasms.
I mean, the rebound...
Is this the key to David's unique success in television?
Do you know what that is?
I have a feeling it's enormously significant, as everything else in this room is. Probably if I touch it, well, it's very heavy.
A small black square object.
I'm really not sure. An early design for a portable television?
Yes, the programmes aren't here. Programmes have deteriorated.
Yeah, the programmes have deteriorated.
Fuzzy black and white footage appears superimposed on the object.
Here now, we all know this eminent author, zoologist, producer, David Attenborough. David, did you have any ambition to become an actor like Dickie?
No, never. I was quite happy to leave it to him. Of course, he was stage-struck from he was that high, and he was always putting up shows of one sort and another and wanting casts, and who better to recruit than his younger brother. He went on to drama school, and I went on to take a science degree, and I think we're both equally surprised to find ourselves in the same medium of television now.
Action.
Using their long, chimp-like arms...
So how did David become such a world-renowned broadcaster? Are there any clues in his upbringing?
Well, I don't think my childhood was particularly different from anybody, from many other childhoods of boys. I mean, I think children are excited by what they see and by finding out about the world about them. I mean, everybody's interested in tadpoles and why they turn into frogs, which is extraordinary and marvellous and wonderful. Everybody thrills to see a butterfly climb out of a chrysalis, you know.
Family used to go on holiday in North Wales on Anglesey, And I used to go on a farm and dress up as a farmer, a ham, and Dave would disappear. You couldn't find Dave anywhere. He was on the beach on Penman Point, on Penman Island, fascinated by the puffins or whatever, but mostly collecting quartz, rocks, fossils, anything that created an atmosphere of the wild and the outside.
Waves lapping over a large fossilized spiral shell, then David tramping through undergrowth.
It sometimes seems that David's simply been pursuing this love of the wild and his passion for fossils ever since.
David walks up to a stone wall.
I used to come to these old ironstone quarries in Leicestershire as a boy to look for them. And the moments of success, when the rock fell apart and revealed a shell that hadn't seen the sun for 200 million years and that I was the first human being to see, seemed to me then, as to be truthful, it still seems to me now, to be moments of magic.
Splitting open a stone to reveal a fossilized shell.
Oh, gosh!
After studying natural sciences at Cambridge, David did his stint of national service and then ended up working for a publisher in London. But it was a far cry from wilderness. He wasn't enjoying himself until one day.
I saw a job advertised in the Times for a radio, BBC radio producer. And I applied for it and I didn't even get an interview. And I think it was like 2 weeks afterwards I got a letter from the BBC which said, we've seen your application and we're quite interested in your qualifications. I know you didn't get the job in radio, but we've got this new thing, it's called television, and a lot of people are rude about it, but we think there could be something there.
BBC Television was then based at Alexandra Palace, Ali Pali to its friends.
And there were the first cameras in the world to produce a public television system.
In 1952, you see, there were perhaps 10 to a dozen people who did all non-fiction broadcasting in the United Kingdom. All. So we all did everything. And gardening and ballet and short stories and quizzes and political programmes and prime ministerial broadcasts and archaeology and natural history, everything.
David started out as a production assistant on a programme called Animal, Vegetable or Mineral, which obviously left quite an impression on him.
Good evening and dobry večer. I'm sure I've said that wrong, but I have to say it that way because tonight the challenging museum is the National Archaeological Museum of Prague.
And here is the first object. Ah,
lovely, isn't it?
A very spirited animal, again. And obviously, like our spirited chairman from the Celtic fringe. Now, how are we getting on?
There are two things you can always say under these circumstances. Either it's a ritual object, or else money. There's always two. You can always say one or two, one or the other.
Okay.
And that is money.
Ritual. Oh.
And they are what my Hungarian colleagues would call a pechel bowl.
Well, it's a sort of silica of some kind. It's a sort of
it is
some
silica.
Volcanic.
It is it volcanic. Material, yes, yes. Two marks.
Yes, two marks.
Yeah.
After how many are we doing? Yes. And it shines like this. Is
it clear? It shines quite good.
Mm. Is it something you use for looking into?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Right.
Yes.
A mirror.
No, really.
Is it really?
Yeah. Really. Oh, very. Oh, very
see,
good.
Yes. That's. Oh.
2000 BC.
Oh, wow.
Good. Yes. Very good. So I'm going to give you three marks.
And the programmes were all live, of course, all of them were live.
And cued music and fade up camera one, and Bill came on the screen and he said, now I am a rat catcher and I'd like to show you what it is I catch. See, and he produced this appalling thing of rat. And then he produced the other one and he said, this one is Rattus norvegicus, a brown rat. And this one is Rattus, the black or sewer rat, and he's the one I'd like to show you first. And then to my horror, he got hold of the cage, lifted the lid, and plunged his hand into this mass of rats, and got the biggest rat I've ever seen by the tail, whipped it out, slammed the lid shut, and started doing this.
Swinging it vigorously.
While he was doing it, he looked
something went in his mind. He looked at the camera and he said, I don't want you to suppose that I am in any way maltreated. But unless I get him slightly dizzy, the bastard will bite me.
A young Michael Parkinson laughs. Next, the opening titles of a black-and-white programme, Zoo Quest.
It feels as though David's always been on our screens. But there was a first time, in 1955.
We hatched a scheme with the London Zoo to go and collect animals. And it was going to be presented from the studio with little bits of film, which we would shoot out on location in Africa, and then the man from the zoo would show these pythons or whatever. Sierra Leone. We were going to look for a bird called Picathartes gymnocephalus. No one had seen its nest, and very few people had ever seen it alive. And so the zoo wanted one, and that's what we went for.
In addition to Picathartes, we hope to take back to London a representative collection of the whole of the animal life of this part of Africa.
That's Jack Lester. He was keeper of the reptile house in London Zoo, in charge of the whole trip. And our job was filming him.
A Gaboon viper, and just as deadly as the cobras. But when Jack heard of it, he was delighted and came running, anxious to catch such a handsome snake for his reptile house in the zoo.
The snake is lifted up by its tail, dropped into a wooden box, and the lid closed. Now drums beating for a tribal African dance. David and Michael sit watching the old footage.
But we were able to produce some magic of our own. For while the dance had been going on, I had been recording the music on my tape recorder. This, of course, was the object of a great deal of curiosity. And I always played the recording back and let the singers listen to themselves on a little earphone. Blank astonishment was always followed by huge grins of delight.
An African woman grins.
Yes, I love David Attenborough's programme. That's remarkable.
On screen, the African women laugh as they listen to themselves on tape.
Dear Jack got very ill as a result of this trip, and the BBC said, OK, well, if Jack Lester can't appear because he's in the London School of Tropical Medicine, Attenborough, go down and do it. And that's the only reason I appeared in this thing at all.
A month ago, Charles Lagos and I returned from spending 4 months in search of a dragon. But we weren't going to keep our eyes shut on the way. We were going to look at many other things.
A very young David swigging from a bottle on board a large sailing boat. Now, David trying to cross a fast-flowing river over precariously placed branches. Then wading through a shallow stream, taking his shirt off, and pouncing on something in a crocodile-infested body of water.
At the time, that's what zoos did. A, so that people could see the wonders of the world. B, so that they could learn about them, so scientists could learn about them. And C, so that you could learn how to, you might be able to breed them. All of which are perfectly laudable propositions. And I still think zoos have got a very good function. But you can't go catching in the free way that we did 50 years ago.
Lassoing an anteater.
And you've got to provide them with much better cages than we did. Enclosures would be a nicer word.
David holds the hand of a chimp in a cage.
I think with dismay at some of the birds that we happily put in aviaries. I don't think birds of prey should be kept in aviaries, really.
David with a cockatoo on his shoulder.
The only reason I've gone on appearing is that I realised after a bit it gave you a certain amount of power to dictate how the programme's going to go.
And when I caught up with them at the top of the pass, I found, to my horror, that the men were refusing to go any further. They told me very firmly that this was the end of their tribal frontier.
And I said, well, now, you know, come on, lads. See, and they said... No good, no good, you see. And I said, why not? They said, we no go long, long him. And why not? I said, him fairly stopped, now, him no good, he kai kai man. That means they're cannibals down there. And I said, now, lads, you know, if it's another sixpence a day once, you know, I mean, we can have a proper organised talk about this, you know. And they said, no, no, him no good, him bad fella, you see. And while while we're actually saying this, with me being very British about the whole thing, and I suddenly looked down the slope and I saw behind a tree a white cockatoo feather flash, And then I turned around again, and there behind a boulder was a glint of a knife. And I thought, oh, being... and while I was in the process of thinking, oh, see, suddenly, out onto the track, about 70 or 80 men suddenly jumped out of hiding and ran down towards us, brandishing spears and waving knives. And to say I was alarmed is to put it mildly. Charles Lagus, who was my companion at the time with the camera, had the presence of mind, he had got it in his hand, simply to turn it. So I know actually what happened. What actually happened was that I walked towards this screaming horde of men, and I actually heard myself. I stuck out my hand and I heard myself say, good afternoon.
Black and white footage of David shaking hands with the leader of the tribe.
To my enormous relief, they greeted me not fiercely, but with considerable enthusiasm. Laughing at myself, I discovered that this, in fact, is merely the normal New Guinea welcome.
David and another man in a small wooden canoe, paddling across a vast body of water.
So at last, we sailed safely into the wide, calm bay of Komodo. This was the home of the dragon which we'd come so far to see.
David wading across a river, leading a team of men.
Within half an hour, there was a rustle in the bush, and there was the dragon. He looked almost as though he had walked out of some prehistoric age.
David peers out from behind a plant.
This was tremendously exciting for us, our first sight of this magnificent monster, the climax of 4 months of arduous travel. All we had to do was to wait.
The dragon plods across a clearing and into a trap.
And down came the door. Hastily, we piled boulders on the door so that he couldn't lift it up. We'd got him.
Oh, respect. Respect. That's fantastic.
Now, David's showing Michael an enormous egg.
ZooQuest ran to 6 series and brought plenty of fresh supplies for David's collection.
So, egg, no point. I mean...
Yes, you don't get any points for that.
No okay. Points.
All right. Well, I mean... really where to begin. It looks like it should come from some almost extinct animal.
Yes. I actually found it myself in bits in Madagascar. Epiornis, the elephant bird.
Really?
The heaviest bird that ever existed and the biggest egg that ever existed. Because if you got an egg that was any bigger than that, it would have to be so thick to hold the contents that the young chick would never be able to hammer its way out.
Yes, that's right. Invalidating the process.
Yeah.
So how many pieces was it?
Quite a lot, I know, 30, I think. Yeah. I mean, it was all found in one place, and I stuck them together originally with camera tape, and it's lived within the air since.
Fantastic.
By the early 60s, David was a well-established television personality. Now it was time for something completely different.
A black and white logo for BBC Two.
Come along, baby, oh.
A team of female dancers twisting and jiving for the camera.
In 1964, the BBC created a second television channel, offering a greater choice to viewers. It received a mixed reception. Some of the programmes were seen as elitist, and there were too many repeats. To breathe life into their fledgling channel, the management turned to a rising young star. Not yet 40 years old, the new head of BBC Two was David Attenborough.
It was an invitation that you simply couldn't refuse. And you were offered several million pounds, said, there you are, go out and create programmes. And you say, well, what sort of programmes should I create? And I say, that's why you've been appointed, my dear child.
And what's wrong with that? What's wrong with having something different for a change?
We begin by welcoming everyone who hasn't been with us before to Late Night Lineup.
The titles for Match of the Day.
And that was a thrilling opportunity. And what I said was, right, well, what we'll do is make new programmes on either subjects or treatments in a way which no other network has ever done. We're not in the business of producing carbon copies of what already exists.
Man Alive.
In other areas, in light entertainment, we shall continue to look for the new stars, the experimental stars, the people who try new lines in comedy, like, in fact, the two successes, obviously, have been The Likely Lads, and Not Only But Also with Peter Cook and Dudley Moore. And in every area, we hope to be trying these new things, these different things.
But I think we must proffer a heartfelt congratulations
for Mr. David Attenborough here.
Bless his heart.
Bless his heart. Bless his heart and heart. Who moved on from the heady world of making wonderful documentary films about the mating habits of Armand and Michaela Dennis.
Peter Cook and Dudley Moore.
To pioneer a system of television unrivaled throughout the whole human world.
It was David who masterminded a dramatic new look for BBC television.
The colour opening titles for Wimbledon from the centre court.
Championship point for the third time for Labour.
In July 1967, he oversaw the launch of Europe's first colour television service.
It's out, and that's the championship.
Next, snooker.
Colour opened up new opportunities. Sports that had been meaningless in black and white became popular viewing.
Golf.
We may not realise just how much David Attenborough created the television we know today.
Two interconnecting golden spheres.
The World About Us was the first hour-long documentary strand. Its success led to greater things.
We just did let ourselves go a little and set up a programme called Civilization, which was to show in colour all the loveliest pictures and loveliest buildings in the whole of Europe.
Michelangelo's David, Notre Dame Cathedral, Botticelli's Primavera, and the Vatican in Rome, the opening titles for civilization.
It does seem hard to believe that European civilization can ever vanish. And yet, you know, it has happened once.
A hand stroking an ancient wooden prow.
Civilization, presented by Kenneth Clark, was the first of the landmark series. Jewels in the crown of BBC television.
The magnificent interior of a hall, then a regal golden bust.
I was most proud of the dynasty of things that started with civilization and went on to the ascent of man.
A drawing of a fetus in the womb in the opening titles of The Ascent of Man.
Those two, it seemed to me, inaugurated a new kind of television documentary, which have had a number of descendants, but in their time they were innovative, and I think they actually enriched people's lives. And what more do you want?
From a man pole vaulting in slow motion to an award ceremony.
And for his achievement in pioneering the philosophy of colour television programmes in Britain, the winner is David Attenborough.
David, in his 40s, accepting the award from Princess Anne, then going over to hug his brother Richard, who's presenting the ceremony.
David was rewarded for his work by being promoted to BBC Director of Programmes. But he missed his film trips to wild places and asked that occasionally he be allowed out of his suit.
I think he was very proud of colour and two and so on. I mean, I think he derived great satisfaction from that and pride, rightly. But it wasn't his scene. Sitting in an office was not his scene. His scene is out somewhere in those ridiculous trousers that are likely to fall off at any moment, or up to his eyes and knees and good in God knows what. That's Dave's world.
You know, there's a whole generation, what you know, who never saw that magic moment in Borneo when you were underground in the cave full of bats.
Yeah.
And you were standing in the pile of the 20-foot-high pile of, what will I call it?
Droppings?
Droppings.
Nor is it just simply bat droppings or bird droppings. It's much more complicated than that, because the entire surface of it is covered with a glistening, moving carpet of cockroaches.
And I've always wanted to ask this question. How did you feel?
Well, I tell you, I stood at the top of that pile, choking with ammonia. This cave, this particular part of it, ammonia is really quite choking. And the director, who was at the bottom, of course, was shouting up, and he said, say something, talk to the camera about what it's like, you see. So I looked at the camera and said, this immense number of bats flying round here in a panic, not one of them is colliding with the other, nor indeed am I in any danger whatsoever of being hit by them.
and they don't fly into your hair or anything because they are so clever with this ultrasound.
And the old fear that people have of bats getting caught in their hair is actually quite unfounded.
And the director said, terrific, cut, and a bat went
straight into his face. Next, a variety of tribal masks.
Through the early 70s, David led a sort of double life, half senior manager at the BBC, half explorer and filmmaker.
An anchor is dropped.
In the series Tribal Eye, he pursued his passion for anthropology. David was the first filmmaker to visit Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands, the scene of a violent rebellion against the white man's rule.
So we sent all kinds of messages. David Attenborough and team, can they come, and the leader will be, and all. And I wasn't at all sure what kind of reception we were going to get.
No idea. It's not set up at all.
The men start running into the sea.
And I thought they were not too friendly.
So were you frightened at all at this moment?
They were trying to get out.
The men surround David's boat.
Lifting the whole canoe out of the water with you in it.
Yes.
They lift the canoe and drag it onto the beach. Later, the leader comes to greet David.
Welcome.
How do you do?
Some
more come later time.
Later?
Yeah,
later. What did you think was going to happen at this point?
Well, I'd no idea.
All right, we go.
Yes, please.
We'd sent a message by radio that said that David Attenborough was coming.
Fantastic.
The younger David stands watching as the inhabitants of the island sing their welcome to him.
I think, thought I was the Duke of Edinburgh.
Right, yeah.
And they got the message wrong. Attenborough, yes. And Edinburgh.
It seems to happen a lot.
And it got slightly more embarrassing because since they wanted to reject everything that was to do with the Westerners they knew,
yeah.
They said that we had to get rid of all our European clothes in order that I could go any further.
But a stranger might only go into this house of memories if he showed proper reverence to the ancient gods and discarded his alien Western clothes. And like everybody else.
Oh, good heavens. Very casual. Very cash.
I can tell you, wet bark cloth around the loins is quite a strange feeling.
What about, well, the camera crew also had
yes,
to fit that.
We all were like this.
Wearing only a thong.
I wonder what the Duke of Edinburgh would say, you see. Bending from the waist downwards with the hands behind the back. It's quite tricky.
The film crew dressed in the revealing tribal costume. Next, a leopard stalking through long yellow grasses.
Meanwhile, at the BBC Natural History Unit in Bristol, an ambitious television series was being developed.
Life on Earth's Chris Parsons.
It became very clear to us in Bristol that what should naturally follow from both the Bonosky and the Clark series was a major work about natural history. We'd already had a reputation for doing some pretty good programmes, but we didn't have an army of what I would call specialist wildlife cameramen, and perhaps the confidence of the people in London to do it.
Right, can we make a start, please?
Nevertheless, a number of people in Bristol, Richard Brock, John Sparks, we're all of the same idea that it's going to be done. It was jolly well Bristol that we're going to be doing it. We'd heard rumours that David, who'd been elevated up and up through the BBC administrative hierarchy, was beginning to get disenchanted.
Everybody could see, I reckon, that an obvious example, an obvious candidate for that kind of treatment was the natural world. And I was on fire to do it myself, and I couldn't do it while I was controller of BBC Two or indeed director of programmes, and I was frightened that somebody else would get it before I could manage to resign and do it myself.
And I got home quite late one evening, and there was an urgent message to phone Dave. It was after the moment I came in, I had to ring him at once. So I dialed the number. I said, "Dave, hang off." He said, "I'm coming down." I thought, "My God, there's something absolutely terrible happened." So he rushed into the house. Dick said, I'm at my wit's end, Dick. I don't know what to do or what to say. I'm likely to be asked to be the new director general." And I said, "So?" "Well, I can't do that, can I?" I said, "No, Dave, I don't suppose you can." "My God, of course I can't. Behind a desk, there's no way in which I'm going to sit in." "Well," I said, "you're absolutely right. Are you asking my opinion?" "Yes," he said. "What is your opinion?" I said, "You'd be a bloody fool if you accepted it. You should go on doing what you're marvellous at and what gives you pleasure."
Flashes of white, yellow and orange light bursting from the surface of a planet in silhouette.
David decided to go with his heart, and the result was a quantum leap in wildlife programming.
Sunlight gradually sweeps across the surface of the Earth in the opening titles for Life on Earth. A Natural History by David Attenborough. A whale and her calf swimming through murky ocean.
There are some 4 million different kinds of animals and plants in the world. 4 million different solutions to the problems of staying alive. This is the story of how a few of them came to be as they are.
A bat flying.
What it did do for the first time was it integrated in a satisfactory way a very big story with David's knack of presentation, which bound the whole thing together into a unity.
David sits on a rock.
The rocks here are getting on for 2,000 million years old.
It was the first time that we'd really taken the story along by the first half of the paragraph being spoken in Tunisia and the second half of the paragraph being spoken in South Africa or something like that.
And then, about 20 or 30 years ago, people realised that they'd been looking in the wrong rocks and in the wrong way.
These are the right rocks.
So you could pick him up in a location 3,000 miles away and remind him of what he said, and he'd go away into a corner and say, "OK, I'm ready to do that now." And he'd come out in the front of the camera and he'd do it, and he'd probably do it in one take.
David walking along the edge of the sea carrying an unlit lantern.
In the series, David told the story of evolution, from the first fossilised signs of life to the most complex living creatures.
Now it's dark and the lantern's lit.
Here, at least, we can get some idea of what things may have been like when their distant relatives, the trilobites, swarmed in the seas of long ago.
Mike Salisbury.
Life on Earth was a continuous story from Programme 1 right to the end of Programme 13, and people were saying, you know, halfway through the series, you know, we don't want to stop watching this. You know, we want to know what happens next. And that's an amazing ability and something that's quite, I think, quite special.
The highlight of the series was perhaps one of the most memorable moments on British television. David's encounter with mountain gorillas in Rwanda.
And this is how they spend most of their time, lounging on the ground, grooming one another. Sometimes they even allow others to join in.
As David lies quietly amongst the family of gorillas, to his delight, one grooms his hair. A gorilla in the branches above him.
There is more meaning and mutual understanding in exchanging a glance with a gorilla than any other animal I know. They're so similar. Their sight, their hearing, their sense of smell are so similar to ours that we see the world in the same way as they do.
The family of gorillas peering out from the dense green foliage. Next, a sloth slowly inching its way along a branch. Then a brilliant blue and green hummingbird hovering by a flower. A vivid green frog lazily cleaning its face. Crabs scuttling by the water's edge. And a line of ants carrying sizable fragments of leaf along a branch.
suddenly you got quite a lump in your throat, that you suddenly thought that for the first time, and it was the first time, it was possible for a single unit and a single man and a single viewer to get a comprehensive view of the planet as a planet.
A glowing, translucent sphere floating up through the sea. Then the sun sweeping across the surface of the planet Earth.
The success of Life on Earth spawned an entire generation of definitive natural history series. The Living Planet looked at how life adapted itself to different habitats and cast David in the role of Action Man.
All living creatures on the Earth and all material objects on it are subject to the pull of one great force, the force of gravity. Were that to be suspended even for a moment, the most extraordinary things would begin to happen. I, for example, would suddenly float into the air because I, at the moment, am flying in an aircraft on a very special course which, in effect, cancels out the effect of gravity.
David and the crew are floating about in the aircraft. He shakes a plastic beaker and water rises up from it in large globules. Next, the flames beneath a hot air balloon and David jumping into the basket. David walking along the mouth of a steaming volcano, being rowed across a turquoise blue sea and climbing a steep sand dune.
Trudging up the face of a dune like this is extremely hard work. Not only am I in the middle of Asia, hundreds of miles from the sea, but I'm over 2 vertical miles above its level. Fine ash is falling all around. There are gusts of choking, poisonous gas. At night, it gets so cold that it can freeze. And that makes this the deepest valley in the world.
High up in a lush jungle canopy.
And the thing about jungles is that they're like a sea, really, a sea of trees. The leaves at the top, 150 feet up, that's where all the sunshine and the wind is. And that's where all the life is. And then as you go down, it gets darker and darker, and there are fewer and fewer animals. So I thought, there must be a way of getting some ladders or something to get up there. A chap called Adrian Warren, who is ludicrously fit, you know what I mean? And he said, oh, he said, it's perfectly simple, we will get up there. He said, we'll get up on ropes. And I said, now, look, lad, you know, how are we going to get up on ropes? He said, easy. And I said, how? And he said, well, you've got these sort of handles with ratchets on them, which will go up. And you have slings, and you put your legs in, and you just work your way up. And when you want to come down again, you just take the rope, and you pass it round here, and you bring that round there, then you unclip this, and then you make sure that you undo that, then you do the other, take 4 more turns round the rope, and fall back, and you'll be absolutely okay. Oh, yes, I said, fine. So I start up this, and for the first 18 inches, it's good, you know. You think, this is amazing. And after about 2 feet, you think, it's quite tiring. And after about 3'6", you think, God, finally, I'm a long way up, aren't I? And when you get actually about 60 or 70 feet up, it is alarming. And it suddenly dawned on me that if I couldn't actually remember what Adrian Warren had told me about the knot, there was no way that anyone was going to come and say, left over right and right over left, you see, because I was up
60
there.
60 feet up the tree.
Spinning slowly, you see. So I thought, well, I've had enough of this. I think I'll do my little bit when I come down now. And I felt very alone. And so I started talking to myself, and I was saying things like, now there is no need to panic. All you have to do is to remember the little rabbit came out of his hole and he went round the log 3 times and then he went back in there. And then I started swearing, you see. And I looked down and I saw the boys from the crew, see, falling about with laughter. And I couldn't think what they were laughing at. And of course, I'd fallen for the oldest trick in the game. I had forgotten that I got a radio mic on. And I heard every word that I'd said.
David hanging hundreds of feet up in the jungle, mouthing a stream of words.
Tales told by those who've travelled with David confirm that vanity is not one of his vices.
I ended up sharing a tent with David, which incidentally I had no clue how to put up, but he put it up and he used to sweep it out in the morning. I used to stand there thinking, gosh, this is the guy who used to be managing director of the BBC, you know, he's sweeping out my tent.
We did one trip in Virginia and he was wading around in the swamp up to his midriff, and we finished that, went to the airport, and then me and him flew to New York, him still in these swamp trousers.
Given three cases to carry, he will always pick the heaviest, and we're all running around like little hens around a rooster trying to stop him, you know, doing some damage to himself by picking up the heaviest case.
His suitcase would go for a high price in the Antiques Roadshow. I mean, it's the most ancient, battered, held together with camera tape, araldite, and he will not give it up.
His trousers, they've done a few series now. In fact, when I was filming in Borneo, the bottoms of his trousers were all frayed, and Vanessa said, look, we can't have you with those frayed trousers. What's wrong with them? I've worn them for years. And quite often before a take, you have to say, oh, David, I think you ought to just smooth your hair down and maybe tuck your shirt in. He's always got a few wine stains and food stains down his shirt, but I think that's what makes him human.
He was always a mess. I mean, if you look at the pictures, I'm rather over sort of dapper, and Dave with his socks down over his shoes and his trousers splitting and his shirt filthy dirty. He doesn't smell. I mean, he's quite pleasant, they're quite clean, but he doesn't give a damn.
David packing his suitcase.
David favours a wardrobe of sturdy predictability, regulation blue shirt and trusty beige trousers.
People say, why do you always wear the same thing? And there's some very practical reasons. One of it, of course, is enables you, in terms of continuity, to cut things together. So that stuff you shot 2 years ago, if you really wanted to stick another thing in, you could put the two together and nobody would know the difference. But the other important thing, as far as I'm concerned, it seems to me that if you change your costume and wear, I don't know, some kind of, you know, I don't know, some kind of fashionable thing, people say, why has he done that? Is it trying to tell us something? I mean, has the climate changed? Or, you know, I mean, what's he trying to do? So you are asking for attention away from what it is you're trying to talk about. So it's much better that the narrator should always have the same thing, so you don't have suddenly appears in a funny hat or, you know, with a feather boa.
I think you should try the feather boa, David, next time.
155.
Action.
On camera, David is the complete professional. The world around him is less reliable.
It's so effective that even a rich woodland like this can seem totally devoid of birds. But that's a completely different sound. That's an aeroplane. There is some life actually within this snowfield itself, because this snow is not white.
As he bends down towards the snow, he ends up sliding down the slope.
Each one of them has his own harem, and I estimate that this one has about 100 females in his. And his sole object in life at the moment is to make quite sure that he and he alone mates with every single one of them. And to that, he must fight. He is so charged up, this being the breeding season, that he will display to almost anything, including me. The volcanoes of today are mere feeble flicks.
He's engulfed in smoke.
1066, take 3 inboard.
Is there anything you wouldn't do?
I'm afraid I've never made a secret of the fact that I'm not in love with rats.
A rat's twitching nose.
And I've had many good reasons for not being in love with rats, but I had the best reason for not being in love with rats only a few weeks ago. I'd been reckless enough to boast over the years that I'd hadn't had a stomach upset for 25 years. And I was in India, and I got one. And I ran for the loo, and I got rid of my problems. And as I was sitting there in extremis, a rat emerged from the depths of the loo and jumped out from between my legs. And I reckon that was not an endearing act.
A rat scuttling down a pipe, then seals trying to escape from killer whales.
David's programmes have never shied away from revealing the darker side of nature. The trials of life shocked us with the apparent cruelty of killer whales.
Very often, the successful hunter takes its victim straight out to sea without even killing it. And there it plays with its catch as if it were exulting in triumph.
The seal is tossed into the air.
How could the natural world be so needlessly violent?
I often get letters, quite frequently, of people who say how they like your programmes a lot, but I never give credit to the almighty power that created nature. To which I reply and say, well, it's funny that the people when they say that this is evidence of almighty, always quote beautiful things. They always quote orchids and hummingbirds and butterflies and roses. But I always have to think too of a little boy sitting on the banks of a river in West Africa who has a worm boring through his eyeball, turning him blind before he is 5 years old. And I reply and say, well, presumably the God you speak about created the worm as well. And now I find that baffling to credit a merciful God, that action. And therefore, it seems to me safer to show things that I know to be truthful and factual, and allow people to make up their own mind about the moralities of this thing, or indeed the theology of this thing. I mean, we made a film about chimps hunting monkeys. That was an extraordinary and powerful and alarming and dismaying thing to see.
Chimps racing across branches in pursuit of monkeys that leap from tree to tree in their bid to escape.
They've got one!
David rushes to take a closer look.
The hunters are tearing it apart.
Again, people say, how can you put on such savagery of a predator catching prey? And you are milking it for violence. If they saw what you put out on the cutting room floor of this animal in suffering, I mean, it's a very narrow line you have to tread. You cannot, in my view, eliminate it entirely. That is to sentimentalize and to distort reality. But equally, some of it is very hard to take. But it was about the reality of what chimps are. And we're very close to what chimps are.
Chimps tearing at the monkey's flesh.
And there's the reward for that long chase. The divided body of a colobus monkey. And if we are appalled by that mob violence and bloodlust, we might also see in that too, perhaps, the origins of the teamwork that have, in the end, brought human beings many of their greatest triumphs.
An Attenborough classic. But is this style of presenting now seen as uncool in the steamy jungle of tabloid television with its prowling packs of aspiring nature jockeys? Or is there life in the old dog yet?
David's presentation style is sort of traditional, but what he allows you editorially is to leap into subject areas that you wouldn't go to otherwise. And actually, the Natural History Unit's reputation, I think, has been largely built around those pieces. The things that no one else would actually do. And I know that whenever I go and see David and say, right, David, what's next? I know I'm not going to get an easy kind of... The subject coming back is going to be something you think, oh, right, we're going to go there, are we?
This is a picture of a mountain that has haunted me, for nearly 50 years, since 1954. Mm. Roraima. And... it's supposed to be the origin of the Conan Doyle novel, you know, where you wonder whether there were dinosaurs on top of
Lost Great Lost World.
That's right.
Fantastic book.
And I didn't get up it and for 40 years, desperately trying to find an excuse to make a programme which would take me to the top of Roraima.
three of us, Mike Salisbury, Neil Nightingale, and I came up with this very sensible programme idea, which was going to be kind of about ecologies, going to be about animals and plants. And plants, we thought, needed to come into the equation, but, you know, you can't do too much on them because they don't move and they're a bit dull. And we heard that David had an idea. He wanted to come up with his next series and was thinking on the same lines.
It is such a spectacular mountain. I mean, when you see it, on the far distant horizon, and then this fabulous, huge, great vertical sandstone walls, it's just a kind of magical, extraordinary place.
So we went to his house, and David has always listened to our idea, and you know, nodded and was very complimentary about it, and then said, but I was thinking about something a little bit bolder.
They'd been, the plants that grow up there had been isolated for so long, are in such a different environment from anything growing down here, that new species of plants have evolved up there.
And sure enough, by the end of lunch, we had all signed up to do 6 hours on plants. I still remember coming back on the motorway down the M4 back to Bristol. Suddenly we all looked at each other and thought, my God, we've agreed with David to do 6 hours on plants.
Not an obvious one to most people, but I was able to work that into a series about plants. Yeah.
Mike Salisbury from The Private Life of Plants.
Talking to the Americans, in this case Ted Turner, over a breakfast, I think, saying, look, Ted, I want to do a series about plants. And Ted saying, well, they're not very interesting, are they? And Jane Fonda, I think, who was there at the breakfast, piped in, said, Ted, I love flowers, we've got to have this series. And so we got the money from America.
The title sequence from The Private Life of Plants. Then the flat summit of Mount Roraima above a carpet of cloud.
Plants cut off up here from the hot rainforest below adapt to their surroundings in their own individual way.
Here it rains almost every day, and sometimes for days on end. I'm in South America, on the top of an immense sandstone plateau, 9,000 feet high, 5 miles across, surrounded by huge vertical cliffs. This is Mount Roraima.
It was such a ridiculous idea to try and bring to the BBC One audience things that don't move, but it ended up really capturing people's imagination.
And this is how they do it.
Speeded up footage of seeds spurting out of a pod. Autumn leaves fluttering down through the sky. A caterpillar on a green leaf. Then dazzling carpets of richly coloured flowers.
The programmes which I've been involved in, always, always the major credit belongs to the cameraman. But it has never been greater, never been more so than in this instance, when the cameraman who did the time-lapse produced such wonderful things. I mean, my jaw sags.
In time-lapse photography, lily pads unfurling on a pond, then the petals of a white flower blossoming between them.
What I like about travel, it's somewhere you really want to go to. You say, oh, perhaps you could fit this in. Yeah, worth a try.
Yeah.
And it's about enthusiasm too. I mean, if you've somewhere you really want to go to, you can
yeah, there are a number of places I would really want to go to that I haven't been to, so I don't suppose I'd go back to Roraima. Or Western Tibet. Mm. The forests of southwestern China. Haven't been there. Have you?
No.
What are you doing? Waste your time.
I'm about 25 series behind you, David.
The world spinning in space. A light aircraft skimming over a thick canopy of trees. Then a busy motorway intersection.
David has witnessed dramatic changes to the natural world in the course of his career. And although he's worked behind the scenes to help many conservation causes, he's been reluctant to make overtly campaigning programmes. In The State of the Planet, he revealed his true feelings.
He's on a rocky promontory overlooking a massive crater.
The future of life on Earth depends on our ability to take action. Many individuals are doing what they can, but real success can only come if there's a change in our societies, in our economics, and in our politics. I've been lucky in my lifetime to see some of the greatest spectacles that the natural world has to offer.
Surely we have a responsibility to leave for future generations a planet that is healthy and habitable by all species.
The surface of the Earth from space, then a hot air balloon over a grassy plain.
But preaching has never really been David's style. He's always seen himself more as a storyteller, an enthusiast.
A black and white clip of a young David.
I personally can have enough of people leaning out of the television screen and saying, "You lazy, irresponsible, ignorant chap sitting there in your comfortable suburban home, why don't you care for this or subscribe to that or go out and do the other?" I actually think the best way of taking the message to the people is by showing them the pleasure. Not necessarily by saying every time, "You've got to do something about it," but by saying, "Look, isn't this lovely?" And the other bit follows.
David in his 20s. He picks up a tiny furry animal and pops it in the top pocket of his shirt. Next, he's walking through a cloud of butterflies.
This is what he does best. For 50 years, David Attenborough has turned his private passions into public entertainment. With his programmes, he's probably done more to stimulate our love of nature than anyone else alive.
David watching a mother seabird feed her chick. A monkey snatching food from his hand on a beach. Next, his head is covered in parrots. And finally, standing opposite a penguin on the ice. Next, he's up to his waist in a swamp.
And to do that, they stood upright on 2 feet, as I'm doing.
He waves to a chimp in the trees above the swamp.
How are you? Nice to see you. Hello.
You reached the official retiring age of 65 11 years ago. Since then, you've made at least 6 major series. Does the word retirement mean anything to you?
Not much, I have to say. I mean, since I've been doing what I'm doing what I want to do, and it's just remarkable that it could be seen as being a career. I mean, I'm extremely lucky that people should want me to go on doing it, and while one has breath in one's body and can get around and not too much of a drag, and people want that, that's just great. I mean, I think it's extremely lucky. I don't know what I'd do otherwise.
David's standing behind an enormous leaf.
The giant arum of Borneo develops the biggest undivided leaf of all. This is the loneliest and the coldest place on Earth.
And this is one of the wettest places on Earth.
This is the biggest flower in the world.
And this is the most massive living thing on Earth.
This is the biggest creature that exists on the planet. Indeed, the biggest one that has ever existed. The blue whale. I can see its tail just under my boat here. And it's coming up, there!
The massive flukes of the whale's tail dramatically rise up out of the sea. Then David spinning in zero gravity, laughing in a jungle, and swigging from a bottle on a boat in his youth.
Stay with us as we look back to the opening episode of one of his landmark series, first shown on this very day in 1979. It's David Attenborough's Life on Earth, next on BBC4.